Listening Library presents Fury Song by Rosaria Munda. Read for you by Christian Coulson, Candice Mole, Aidan Kelly, Anthony Mark Barrow, and Steve West. Prologue. The girl watched her father dig. The fields were quiet. Hetty and Lila were inside with the village women, preparing the body. Garrett had wandered up the mountainside in the morning, and Rory worked on the opposite end of the grave, widening while their father deepened. The highlands in winter were cold and windy and slightly wet.
"Will Mama go in there?"
the girl asked. Her father paused to wipe sweat from his neck. "Aye."
"And the baby will go here, if he dies?"
Dar's pause was longer. "Aye."
"Go inside, Annie,"
her brother Rory said, his voice cracking.
"Go inside with the women." "Did the baby kill Mama?" "Dar, send her in."
"Rory, take a break."
Rory threw down his shovel. The girl eyed the shovel as Rory stalked away across the field.
"I can dig,"
she said. The grave was already deep enough that it would swallow her if she climbed down into it, but she wasn't afraid. Her father, who could always tell when she was trying to understand, hoisted himself from the half-dug grave to sit beside her on the edge of it. He smelled of earth and sweat. His beard nuzzled her cheek when he drew her into his arms. The two spades were propped against his knee. "The baby didn't kill your mother," he said. "The hunger killed your mother. The lords killed your mother when they took our food." The girl thought the baby might still be to blame. The baby was what caused the pain and the blood, not the lords. She didn't think Dar wanted to hear that.
"You are very sad, Dar?"
Rory would tell her to stop asking questions, but Rory was on the other end of the clearing, glaring at the valley below. And Dar always answered her questions, even the ones that made him pause for a long time and close his eyes. "Sad," Dar said finally. "And angry."
"You're keeping it inside?"
"I'm keeping it inside."
This was the refrain they had before collections. "When our Lord comes, whatever you're feeling, you keep it inside. You keep it inside, because that's where it's safest." Her father took her hand in his, so that it was her finger that he pointed at the unbroken ground next to them.
"There's space beside this grave for me, and beside that for your brothers and sisters."
She did not cry. She kept it inside.
"No,"
she said.
"Not yet."
"Not yet," he agreed.
She heard how he said it and changed her mind.
"Never,"
she said. His surprise rumbled through his belly.
"My little skylark, my sky-sung queen," he said. "You are awfully young to be giving orders."
This was silly because she wasn't a queen and couldn't give orders, but she curled closer and didn't laugh. When he ran a hand over her hair, his palm cupped her entire head.
"Did your mother ever tell you that you have her hair?"
The girl touched her fringe.
"I have my hair,"
she said. He smiled, lines splitting his face, beard rippling. It had been days since she'd seen him smile.
"You have your hair, but it came from her," he said. "Brown as the earth, red as flame. You take her with you."
She tucked a finger into her hair and wrapped a curl around it, thinking, "I have a piece of my mother with me, a secret piece." When he set her on her feet and told her to go inside and help prepare the body, she went. Her father finished digging the grave alone. The baby, who died not long after, was buried alongside his mother. As winter turned to spring and spring to summer, her sister Lila took over her mother's chores, and she and her sister Hetty took over Lila's. Lila braided their hair as their mother used to do. In secret, out of earshot of Rory and Lila and Dar, she and Hetty sometimes played the old game, Mama and Baby, but it took on a desperate edge, like pretending had the power to bring her back.
No, you have to say it like Mama said it,
Hetty said. But she was starting to have trouble remembering how Mama said it.
I have Mama's hair,
she told Hetty, who did not. Hetty burst into tears. She watched, keeping her feelings inside where they were safest. She asked Hetty if she wanted to play a different game, and Hetty gulped and wiped her eyes and nodded. They played Burn Down the Village instead, and she let Hetty be the Dragon Lord. For a few warm months, they had enough to eat, but not enough for the tax and the coming winter. The blight was back. In late summer, when the hair her mother gave her was streaked with gold from the sun, storm-scourged dragons were seen in the sky again. The Dragon Lords had returned to their country estates for the season and would soon begin harvest collections. In the house of Don Mackey, one of the village leaders, the men of Holbin added the Crier's latest decree to the pile of notices delivered in the name of Leon Stormscourge and the Drakarchy of the Far Highlands. The girl, who had slipped in among the men unnoticed, studied this decree as she had studied the earlier ones, upright on her knees on the Mackey's long bench between her father and Rory. The men spoke of cellars and hiding and hoarding, and how much was too much to hide, but she didn't listen.
Too risky, Don Mackey said. So is another winter after blight, her father said.
What does insubordination mean?
The girl asked.
Insubordination, her father corrected automatically. It means when you disobey your lord. Silas, said Don Mackey, nodding at her. Look at your daughter.
The conversation paused as they looked at the girl, who was moving a finger along the writing of the decree, her lips forming silent syllables as she remembered the crier's words. She had been doing this at their meetings for months now, sandwiched unnoticed in her father's shadow. By now she understood enough of the words on the page to be able to take apart the symbols and turn them back into sounds.
She isn't. I think she is.
Dar placed a finger at the top of the page.
What does it say, Antigone?
The girl moved his finger from the right side of the parchment to the left.
It starts here, she said.
Her father brought her to all the meetings after that on purpose. The men of Holbin welcomed her, not because they had anything new for her to read, because she had become, in some way, a talisman. This tiny girl, with her too big name, who was as clever with letters as any lord. Sometimes they would have her read old decrees for their delight. Sometimes her father would lift her on his shoulders to carry her home, and she felt tall enough to touch the summer stars and pretended she was soaring overhead like the dragons that crossed their skies.
You're faking it, Rory said. Dar only believes you can read because you're his favorite.
The first part hurt her the most, because it wasn't true. But she knew the second part was what hurt Rory.
I'm not, she said.
When she told Lila about it, Lila told her not to give Rory any mind. He was bitter because he had been Mama's favorite, and now she was gone. She noticed how Lila said it.
Whose favorite are you?
She asked Lila, who was plaiting her hair.
No one's,
said Lila, after a moment of thought.
Then you'll be mine, and Hetty can be yours, and Garrett can be Hetty's, so that it's fair.
She felt pleasure at working this solution out. It was like the scales the Lord's secretary used on collection day, except she imagined not just two trays, but five. Lila, Rory, Hetty, Garrett, and her. All with someone who favored them, hanging in perfect balance.
You silly girl,
Lila said with a smile in her voice and tied off the braid.
You can't make everything fair.
Collection day approached. Cellars were dug and stocked and hidden. The men argued about how much was safe to set aside. Dar made his cellar the largest of all, and swore on his wife's grave that no child of his would go hungry again this winter. The boys practiced bowing, the girls practiced curtsying, and Dar made sure they knew the pleas by heart, just in case. In the past, this had been Mama's lesson, and Dar had resented it. This year, as it became his lesson, he drilled them until they knew the lines cold. Mama had always assured them they would never be needed, but Dar made no such promise. Instead, he added a lesson of his own. They watch us kneel. They see the back of our heads, and they think we've given in. They don't realize you can think from your knees just as well as from your feet. They were practicing in front of the house. The door to the hidden cellar was buried under reeds 3 meters away. The children were kneeling, their father standing in front of them, playing their lord. Up until this point, there had been a fair bit of giggling, as Hetty and Garrett poked each other and attempted stiff faces. But at Dar's last words, all poking ceased. They could feel the gravity of what they did rooting them to the earth. Rory, Dar asked his kneeling son, what are you thinking of?
I'm thinking of the grain my lord doesn't know we've hidden safe, Rory told the ground.
Dar went down the line, asking the same question of each child. When he asked Antigone, she said,
I'm keeping what I'm feeling inside.
Looking at the ground, she couldn't see her father's expression. Good, he said. On collection day, Dar and Rory hauled the cart loaded with grain and other offerings down the path into the center of the village square. Lila carried the gift basket of bread, and the younger children trailed in a line behind. The dragon perch was already shadowed with its visitor, a storm scourge with red-tipped wings and a red crest. Lila told them it was bad luck to look, but when Lila wasn't looking, she risked a glance up at the great storm scourge and found slitted eyes staring back at her. She felt a pulse of fear, but also something else, excitement. The talons, the wings, the gleaming scales made the most beautiful animal she'd ever seen. The queue moved slowly. Their lord took his time asking after each household, with a gracious smile and gently accented Kalish. When the time came for her family, the cart was wheeled up for inspection while they made obeisance as they had practiced. She held her breath as numbers were murmured and shared with their lord. Would he notice that their offering represented only a fraction of what they had hidden in the cellar? The secretary frowned over the sums and was about to bring a question to Leon when Leon's attention was caught by something else. Your wife, he said. Why isn't she here? Silas laced his fingers across his waist. She passed, Lord, in childbirth. She noticed that he did not give the causes of death he'd given her. He didn't mention the hunger or the blight or Leon's taxes. I'm sorry to hear that, Silas, said Leon. He did look it. He had very kind, gray eyes that turned on Silas's family arrayed behind him in concern. The secretary paused. Lips pursed. She leaves behind a beautiful family, Leon said. Thank you, Lord. Have they all been presented to me? The youngest. Forgive me, I forget myself, Lord. This is Antigone, who only just attained the age of reason. Lila applied pressure, unneeded, at her back as she redoubled her curtsy under their lord's gray gaze. Antigone, Leon mused. That's a dragon tongue name. He sounded thoughtful, and as his interest was caught, so was the dragon's overhead. Its head perked, crest rising ever so slightly along its back, as it swung round to observe its rider and the family he interviewed. Her neck prickled at the dragon's attention, but no smoke issued from the nostrils, no warning sign. A tremor was in her father's voice when he answered. I heard it in a song. Beg pardon, my lord, I hope it does not offend. Not at all. I like to think proud names among my serfs only increases the pride of Stormscourge House. Silas bowed. The dragon lowered its head and its eyes slid shut again. Leon told the girl, I have a son a little older than you.
Lorat,
she answered, keeping her eyes on his fine boots. Leon Stormscourge nodded to his secretary, who rolled his eyes to the cloudless sky in exasperation. The secretary took two loaves from their family's gift basket, stacked them in Antigone's arms, and announced in reedy palace-standard Kalish,
A condolence for your family's loss.
She tightened her arms around the returned bread and curtsied to her lord, keeping her feelings inside. Silas growled.
May my lord accept the gratitude of his servant for kindness undeserving.
Glancing up at her father, bent double, she saw that his neck was bright red. Leon flicked a wrist, and the secretary called,
Next!
There was celebration in the village that night. The grain offerings had passed muster. The excuses had been bought. Leon's good temper had left the whole Binner's schemes successful. In Silas's house, the bread their lord had taken and then given back to them was torn and dipped in honey that had been hidden in the secret cellar and turned into a feast. They toasted their lord for his mercy and his stupidity. They toasted the mother he had killed. The following morning, a shadow passed over their fields. A red-crested storm scourge landed in front of Silas's house. The soldiers, who came down from Harfast and the seat of the Western Triarchy, trickled into the village and surrounded Silas's yard. Leon was just as mild-mannered today as he had been the day before.
I have spoken with my secretary. It seems there has been a mistake.
Silas didn't bow the way he bowed the day before, from the waist. He got to his knees and placed his hands in the mud. Behind him, his children did the same. It was what they had practiced, except this time, it was not pretend. He began to recite the pleas he had taught his children, the ones used only at the end. Some soldiers stood between him and his family, surrounding the house, while others searched the yard. When the secret cellar was discovered, Silas ran out of pleas.
Your favorite?
Leon said. It seemed to be a question, but Silas was unable to answer it. As her father began to weep, she thought, he needs to keep his feelings inside. She was so transfixed, watching her father, watching her lord and the dragon bearing down, that she did not notice Rory until he was pulling her to her feet. He rubbed two palms against his eyes.
Go to our lord,
he said. The last thing she wanted was to go closer to their lord or his dragon.
No. Annie, go,
he said. His voice, which cracked and rose so often when it was used against her, was suddenly very calm.
You'll be all right.
Lila gave her a little push, and her feet began to walk. She walked toward the dragon lord, and her father was led away from him. She tried to remember afterward how they had crossed paths in the space between the dragon and the house. Had he knelt to greet her, to ghost one last kiss on her forehead as she walked away from death and he walked toward it? The truth was, she couldn't remember passing him at all. Only the dragon and the lord and her leaden steps toward them as they loomed over her. And then she turned to see her father behind her, his back to her, being led with her siblings into the house.
Hello again, Antigone,
said Leon kindly, as he saw who had been chosen.
Come here.
He set his hand on the back of her neck, as a father might a child he wanted to calm, or a rider with a restless dragon. The storm scourge beside him was alert, nostrils smoking. She no longer found it beautiful. Leon lifted his voice and pronounced his sentence in dragon tongue. She did not understand at the time, but years later, remembering the name of the punishment, she looked it up and read the words in a library far away. recognizing them for the first time. For he who earns the dragon's punishment, let his home be his tomb. He gave the order to his dragon, and her home became a tomb. When the fire started, she tried to keep her feelings inside, but they didn't stay. They spilled out, along with the pleas she had been taught as she began to recite them. Leon ignored the feelings, and he ignored the pleas too. He held her gently, but he did not let her look away. "Yes," he said finally. "It is a terrible waste." He turned her toward him and wiped her eyes with gloved thumbs. He stroked her hair the way her father had at her mother's graveside, and she was so distraught, she clung to him. "There, child, you've learned your lesson now, haven't you? You'll tell your father's friends down in the village." Leon settled her on her feet and took to one knee to meet her eyes, as if he were used to giving lessons in the way a child could understand. "When you try to defy us, we take everything."
Part 1. Revolution. 1. The Reckoning. Dilo, New Pythos. It's the eve of the long-awaited return, and I'm about to lose everything. Everything. That is what he's become for me, this boy who kneels beside me as I stare down my family, my court, as if I were alien to them. Griff Garrison, the humble rider, the peasant, whom I never was supposed to love. I look down at his damp curls, at the burns that glaze the muscles of his neck, and wish we were alone, so that I could kiss them one last time. I marvel at how steadily he holds his head. Does he not realize what is happening? "Why did you give it to him?" Lady Electra asks. "My crime? I gave Griff Garrison the key to his muzzled, chained dragon, which he used to find Antigone, first rider of the Kallipolan fleet, and turn spy against us. Tonight, Griff's crimes have been uncovered, even as our plan proceeds unfoiled. Ixion still sets out to bring Kallipolis to its knees, with the help of a foreign princess and a promise of bread. I'm closer to returning to my home now than I've been in these 10 long years of exile. I should be glorying in our triumph. But all I can think is that the one I love is about to be dropped. The dragonborn exiles in this room look at me, look at him, and make their assumptions. They assume I was a love-struck fool, too smitten to ask what he did with that key. I was smitten. I am smitten. But I was never a fool. I didn't ask what he did with that key, but I knew. I let him. Why? That is the question that turns over and over, like sea smooth stones knocking in my hand. Why did I enable this treachery? I've prepared for the long-awaited return to Kallipolis as eagerly as the rest of them. I long to go home. I feel the absence of the Skyfish Summer Palace, like the ache of a missing limb. Still waking up, 10 years later, from dreams where I smell the Medean wafting through sunlit marble halls and hear the ghostly laugh of a mother the usurpers took from me. "It's been a pleasure serving all of you," says Griff, bowing low, before he's dragged from the room. Once he's gone, Father makes the one demand commensurate with my failure. "You will be the one to drop him." Hours later, in my chambers where I wait for dawn, a knock sounds on the door, and my surroundings return to me. The tomes spread across my desk contain the old poems with their heroes. I've been staring at them, We'll see. Since I lit the lamp and slumped in this chair hours ago. The childhood comforts have not worked tonight. Outside the door, I find a young Norsian woman holding a note. Mabelena, called Lena, was once a humble rider, like Griff. Her limp, her strangely angled limbs, and her lopsided face a reminder of the punishment she suffered 6 years ago. Found guilty of sedition and dropped, as Griff will be. Though only an idiot would believe sweet, bumbling Mabelena capable of anything that they accused her of. She served in the citadel ever since. Her quarters are in the dungeons, in an unlocked cell. There's no point locking Lena in. She has nowhere left to go. For her, the drop was a life sentence of pain. For Griff, it will be an execution. A message from Lord Rode, my lord. Rode has written, "Do not despair so soon, brother. There are plenty more peasants to warm your bed." Moments like this, I strain to remember the childhood in which Rode and I were friends. I look over the letter at Mabelena, who waits with eyes downcast, her face placid, her usual matted hair limp, as if a coarse brush had been recently forced through it. It's hard to believe, looking at this broken girl, that she ever rode on a dragon's back. The unasked questions shriveled on the vine years ago. Do they touch you? Do they hurt you? The same questions I learned not to ask Griff when Julia started summoning him and laughing about it afterward. What could I do with my knowledge? Nothing. And when nothing can be done, discretion is the last decency. I used to wonder what was wrong with me for caring. Whether it's me who is perverse or my family remains a matter of opinion. But with Griff about to drop, it's a little late for my cure. I take two steps to the fire and drop the note in it. Mabelena watches the parchment burn with flames reflected in her eyes. How is the Calipolan prisoner? Mabelena's eyes dart from the fire to my face. What tear stains she sees there. She doesn't linger on. He struggles with sorrow spells still, she says. Missing his skyfish. But he's kind. We speak a little dragon tongue. Daily he improves. His wounds heal. All the prisoners are Mabelena's charges. But I noticed, when I surrendered Duck Sutter into her care 2 months ago, after finding him improbably alive in the rubble of a blaze site, that she took particular interest in his rehabilitation. The Calipolan's sorrow at the loss of his dragon is something she understands, just as she knows what it is like to survive a fatal drop and live with a shattered body, as Duck Sutter has had to do. I hoped they would help each other. All the same, I'm not prepared for what Mabelena murmurs next. The Calipolan has been sunlight to my darkness, my lord. She sounds as if she isn't sure it's a good thing. Her expression is, for a moment, so vulnerable it looks naked. Sweet Mabelena, who fell so hard, doesn't she know that happiness is something we're not allowed? I gesture at the armchair between us, and Lena eases into it like a perching bird. I take the seat opposite. The expression on her scarred face grows all the more disconcerted as I pour wine into two goblets and offer her one. She drinks when I drink. Griff has been found guilty of treason. Her fingers tighten on the goblet, understanding, as only Mabelena could, what that word forebodes. Father has ordered me to do it. Then you should, she says. Only when she says it, and I feel no surprise, do I realize this is what I needed her to say. Because I've been thinking it too. Lena's eyes are ice gray, like they've been drained of color. You can assure that it is done well for the sake of his family. You can assure that his family is spared. Last time, Rode did it. He was the one who decided to drop Lena's family and then her. I've closed my eyes. A soft pressure cools my face. Mabelena has placed her fingers on my cheek. Before Rode gave me his message to deliver, she murmurs, I saw your Griff in the cell where they put him. He had a message too. I look at her, and now my heart is racing. What did he say? He said to take Jephira out before the drop. Take a long flight. Summon your courage. Make your vigil. And when you come home, do your duty.
Annie. They intend to drop Griff at dawn, but we're ready long before that. The pillars of caste surrounding New Pythos are black fingers against a grey sky when Ayla and I leave the lairs of the Hay Aurelian Citadel. On the crown of thorn-rosed caste, among winter-dead brambles overgrowing their shrine of standing stones, Griff's sister, Aga, hides with her two children. They were moved here for their safety in the night. The three of them emerge when Ayla lands, and the little boy, Garrett, beckons me to a place on the edge of the cliff where I can watch for sunrise. Garrett. The same name, and nearly the same age as my brother when he died. Our languages, Kalish and Norish, share roots like they share damp winters and long hungers. I can't help feeling that I've got more in common with this peasant family on the other side of the sea than I do with the Kallipolan elites who have been my classmates for the last 10 years. Aga's barely older than me. Her daughter, Becca, watches from a pace apart, her eyes travelling slowly from me to the dragon and back. She blinks very little, as if we might vanish if she doesn't keep her eyes wide open. It's done, I tell Aga. Her voice is pitched low. The poison. The lairs were still dark when Ayla and I left them. The smell of smoked fish and charred leather was identical to that of the nests in Kallipolis, though the murmured Norish of the squires, Griff's friends, was too quiet for a semester's worth of study to understand. I did not know these dragons, but they did. And they were the ones I gave the amphora of Drachthenacia to and told to divvy it up. The squires did it. Ayla and I took care of the muzzles. With a squire named Fiona leading the way, Ayla and I wormed our way down the damp corridor of the lairs, Ayla taking each iron muzzle into her mouth one by one and breathing fire on it until the metal glowed and snapped. When we freed Fiona's, a tawny Aurelian with deep black eyes, the woman's shoulders slumped in relief and the dragon whimpered. Aga's eyes are rimmed white in the grey light. They can fly free. They can fire. I nod. The squire on duty will release them on our signal. I ask Aga to show me where the drop will take place on the silhouette of the main island. Her trembling finger identifies Conqueror's Mound, a sloping hill at the centre of the Norsian villages opposite the Hay Aurelian Citadel, overshadowed by the statue of an invading lord. The Norsians will be summoned to witness and learn the lesson. Griff Garrison, dropped for treason. Griff Garrison, dropped for conspiring with the Kallipolan First Rider. Dropped for conspiring with me. And we will turn this moment into the opportunity Griff needs to stage his revolution. Aga's grandfather Grady is rallying the four trusted clans now, waking village elders and spreading word to prepare for war. I don't think you poisoned all of them, Aga says. I'm about to ask her how she knows, There were empty stalls where some of the dragons should have been, leaving us all with a lingering unease. Ixion's storm scourge, Nita, was not among them, nor was the dragon that belongs to Freyda, the Basileian princess he's courting. Her Goliathan, a great breed from the continent, is rumoured to be large enough to blot the sky. The squires filled the troughs of the missing dragons with poisoned feed anyway, assuring me that those absent must only be on patrol and would be back before dawn. When I follow Aga's gaze now, I realise she means a specific dragon. A skyfish has breached the clouds a few miles out, her slender silhouette a grey line against the wisps of fog hanging low in the morning, her narrow wings a crossbar as she glides. Her rider looks like a tiny toy soldier atop her back. I stretch a hand toward Ayla, stilling her. Everyone get down. We slide to our knees in the bracken as the skyfish streams overhead. Garrett's shrill voice hisses as his neck cranes for a glimpse of the dragon.
Isn't that Japhira? It's Dilo, Sir Japhira. We don't have to fear Dilo.
Aga forces Garrett's head down and breathes her answer.
Today we do.
I feel a small hand slip into mine and find Becca crouched beside me. She looks up, not at the dragon, but at my face. Her tiny nails dig into my palm. Beside us, Ayla's amber wings hug her sides, and her neck twists so that one slitted pupil can take in the dragon passing overhead. With a flick of her tail, Japhira vanishes into the streaks of fog above us. Becca's fingers untwine from mine. Garrett shrugs off his mother's arm. We unfold from our crouches, and Aga's gaze lingers on the clouds into which Dilo Sir Japhira vanished.
Poor boy, she murmurs. They'll make him do it.
I remember the way Griff's voice caught when I taught him how to write his family's names, and he asked to add a single more. The way he carefully spelled Dilo Skyfish in a practice notebook. I get to my feet, brushing twigs from my knees. I thought the Dragonborn were accustomed to taking peasants into their beds.
Their beds, yes. Not their hearts.
So, less like the dragon lords of old, and more like Lee and me. Or like we would have been if his father were still alive, and Lee's loyalty still to his people when he learned to love me. Come back to me, Lee said. And I will, as soon as I get this job done. At least Griff will be the only one he'll have to drop. The squires told me that the last time a Norsian rider was dropped in punishment, her family was dropped too. They whispered her name, Mabelena. The story, and their awed horror, was too familiar for comfort. Across miles with a sea between us, with fire or without, the dragon lords punish families in the same way. I was my village's Mabelena. So I was the one who insisted we move Aga and her children here, for their safety, until the plan is completed. Because this has been my concern, I'm a little surprised at what Aga chooses to say next. I am grateful for your help today. Her children can't hear her low voice over the whistling wind. But I want you to know, when I heard he'd been meeting with you, I wept. There is a fire in her eyes, not unlike Griff's, as she holds her son's shoulder and dares to look me in the eye. It has taken her courage to say this. I can see how her gaze darts to my dragon, then my face. There must have been a moment when my father imagined the cellar he could dig and decided to make the gamble that would bring dragon fire down on our heads. Aga knows. And I know. that I was that gamble for Griff. I am the recourse to violence. I am the last resort. At best, I am the lesser evil. I'm a dragon rider, and I'm here to do my job. You were right to weep. I reach for Ayla's saddlebag. I removed my flame suit and armor under the cover of her wings in dunes, far from here, mere hours ago. Lee's trembling fingers unhooked the clasps. The dress and hair scarf I'm wearing are Aga's, borrowed by Griff, and I'm conscious of her stare as I unwrap them. Perhaps beneath these burn scars, she sees a peasant's body like hers. Or maybe she just sees a city girl raised in luxury, a lifetime of square meals making up for a childhood of famine, shaping me into something unrecognizable. Shivering, I strip and shimmy into my flame suit. I fasten the clasps that Lee undid as brambles scrape the goosebumps on my bare skin. When I reach for coolant, I find small hands holding up the saddlebag.
I can help you.
Aga's arm jerks to restrain Becca.
Becca, don't get in her way.
But Becca shies free, and I hear myself say, it's okay. Becca makes a very attentive assistant. She watches while I unscrew the suit's coolant valves, fit the canister to them, and top them off. When it's time to do the back of my suit, she steps closer still.
I can do it.
I take a knee so that I'm at her height.
Thank you.
I can feel small fingers twisting each valve along the shoulders of the back of the suit.
What's it for?
If I get burned, I flood the suit. Then it hurts less. Aga's palm is rubbing so hard against her chin as she watches us, I think she might chafe it.
I want to ride a dragon when I grow up, like you. I'll be first rider.
I'd almost forgotten until she says it, that it's a title I once longed for too. It's not an easy job. Becca shrugs.
I'm not scared.
She sets the canister down.
Now the armor.
Now the armor. I show her how to layer the plates, the cuirass, the pauldrons, the arm guards and leg guards. When it's time to arm Ayla, I show her how the breastplate fastens across her soft underbelly to provide an extra layer of protection against javelins from below. Ayla holds still, a single lidded eye following Becca's work as her tail twitches. She likes you. Becca stares up at the dragon, and it's unclear whether her question is for Ayla or me.
Are you going to save my uncle?
Ayla snorts a small puff of smoke. Yes, I answer.
Are you going to free Norcia?
Aga, watching, looks stricken. Ayla lowers her snout to Becca's outstretched hand, and trembling fingers touch the flare of amber scales between her nostrils. I hope so.
I can help,
Becca says. I remember reaching for a shovel at the graveside, telling my father the same thing. I understand now why he put his arms around me instead of answering. I show her my arm guards. You have helped me. See? A sliver of pink shows along the horizon where the low clouds end. The bells of the citadel echo faintly across the water. The portcullis is opening, the procession about to begin. When I reach for my helmet, Aga is the one who holds it out to me.
Shrines keep you, she says.
Lee, Callipolis. On the morning of the first people's assembly, I wake to fears for Annie and the revolution she has gone to spark abroad. I don't think to be worried about what would happen today, at home, in Kallipolis. Even when I'm warned by a ministry official that something might be afoot, a triarchist conspiracy to return my family to the throne, I dismiss it. I dismiss it until the moment Ixion Storm Scourge, my cousin, lands beside me in the center of the Eyrie at the opening of the assembly. Ixion has studied his revolutionary history as well as I have. He knows how coups succeed and fail. He wastes no time informing me the gates to the dragon's nests have been closed. The senior officials of the revolutionary regime are surrounded in the palace box, and the guardians are sequestered in the cloister. Then he offers the people Freda's bread and credits me with it. We stand shoulder to shoulder on the Eyrie, looking upon the first people's assembly in a decade. Overhead, the Goliathan and its princess circles under a bright sun and blue sky, casting a shadow of empire over the city-state of Kallipolis. "You have watched the revolutionary regime fail you," Ixion tells the assembly. "You have suffered because of Atreus Athanatos's incompetence. You have longed for a return to the rulers who were born to serve you." He twists his arm with mine. I could wrench it free and decry the maneuver. But already I wonder how deep the plot goes. Directly before the assembly, Miranda Hayne warned of a shadow organization, a triarchist group that has been conspiring with Ixion from the inside, the Order of the Black Clover. Assuming Ixion has more backup than I realized, the Guardians and their dragons are in danger. And assuming he's not lying when he tells me Duck's alive and captive in New Pythos, he has the leverage of Annie's closest friend and Kor's brother. I let my arm rise with his. "Let us return to our roots," Ixion says. "To what is right. To what is natural. And let this hunger, this injustice, this scourge of 10 years be forgotten." The People's Assembly votes to reinstate the Triarchy as rightful rulers of Kallipolis. They accept Freda's offer of food aid from her empire. So long have they suffered and hungered, they don't even seem to remember that it was Ixion's airstrikes that caused the food shortage in the first place. Or perhaps, with the shadow of a Goliathan circling, they're not keen to protest the point. "And all because of my cousin, Leo Stormscourge, whose invitation made possible our return," Ixion tells the assembly. It's bad enough to watch the reform I fought for be subverted. It's worse, by far, to hear my name cheered in thanks for it. The nation whose aid we invited was Deimos, a dragonless democracy. But it's too late to correct Ixion now. The applause is deafening. "You're an idiot," I tell Ixion, because I feel like the biggest idiot of all. Big talk from one who just got played as bad as you. "I got played?" I jerk a thumb upward at the Basileian princess circling on her Goliathan, who just added another province to her empire. "Do you refer to my future wife?" I stare at him. Surely he can't be that stupid. But he grins back, so it looks like he is. "Anyway," he waves at the populace, "I think we know who the real idiots are right now. They are hungry. Well, they won't be for much longer. Freda's grain shipments are due to arrive within the week. Along with her troops." Ixion lifts a shoulder, a non-committal confirmation. "So, we're to be occupied. Whatever deal he made was in exchange for Kallipolan autonomy. The assembly referendum in favor of it was just window dressing. Freda's forces are going to arrive whether or not they are invited. The citizens at this assembly who haven't surmised that yet will find out soon enough. The slowly spiralling descent of Freda's Goliathan encompasses the whole of the upper bank, and we make our way down the ramp of the Eyrie in her shadow. At the palace entrance to the arena, out of sight of the public, we are met by Lucian Orthos, General Holmes's chief of staff and an aide. On Orthos's lapel, I see the black clover of the Triarchy in Exile. You? He always was intolerable, in class and to Annie at meetings of the War Council. But this takes it to a different level. Lucian barely glances at me. Holmes and the High Council have been contained, along with Athanatos, my lord. Atreus's less commonly used family name. Good, says Ixion. The aide's fingers are shaking as he pats down my guardian uniform, but he does it anyway, not meeting my eyes. He retrieves the boot knives from my dragon riding boots and shows the inlay of one of them to Ixion. The heather of Stormscourge House entwines with the initials my father and I share, L.S. The boot knife belonged to my father, but Ixion doesn't know that Annie was the one who found and gave it to me. He studies the heirloom and looks up. You, Ixion says, are not the shit I was expecting. That's funny. I was going to say you're exactly the shit I was expecting. Ixion lets out a bark of laughter. He nods to Orthos's man. A fist pummels me in the stomach. I double over, gasping. Here we go.
2. The Drop. Griff, New Pythos. The only question in my head, as I'm led out of my cell, through the citadel, and down to Conqueror's Mound just before dawn, is what will happen to my family when I'm dropped. Mabelaina's were rounded up when she was. I've no reason to expect anything different. I don't dare wonder whether Antigone Sir Aela made it across the water from Callipolis, or the poison made it into the feeding troughs as planned. My thoughts are on my sister, her little ones, and Granda, who still waits for a lost son to return from the sea that swallowed him. I promised Aga I'd protect them. The world is still grey and colourless, dawn not yet on the faces of the ones gathered to watch our procession. The gulls are too sleepy to cry, and the salty air lies still and damp. It feels like the whole island waits, hushed. Griff, I begged a boon. A tiny voice splits the silence with dragon tongue, and I twist to take in the youngest Haeralian, Astyanax. He's trotting alongside me as I'm led by my chained arms behind Sparker's cart. I can hear the boy's nurse hissing at him behind us, but he pays Shay no mind. He's Garrett's age. My life? I ask in surprise. Astyanax beams and shakes his head. Sparkers! He looks so proud of himself, my heart warms. Better Sparker than me. That'll do nicely, little lordling, I tell him. He trots back to his glowering family, and I'm led to the top of the mound. It reminds me too much of Mabelaina's drop. Sparker tied to the cart in front of me, his tail thrashing fruitlessly against the chains that bind him. The household turned out, squires and Haeralians and dragonborn exiles, to watch me take the fall. And surrounding us, a grey sea of pinched faces spread across the mound. The Northians who have been forced to attend. Astyanax swings nervously on his mother's arm, beside the great lord Rhadamanthus. I scan Clan Nag's turnout for my family, and find none of them. Where are they? My panicked imagination invents reasons. They were taken. They're being held, ready to be dragged out in chains and dropped beside me. Dilo steps forward. His skyfish, Japhira, waits behind him, and we are encircled by the remaining triarchal dragons and their riders. Faemy, Delos' sister, the long silvery blue tail of her skyfish cutting a swath through the cringing villagers, Uranus and Orion, lesser Haeralian cousins, side by side on their stump-necked Aurelians, glaring down at us. And Roxana and Rode, the great lord's eldest children, flanking their parents like an honor guard on Dragonback. Rode winks at me. He's probably supposed to take over if Dilo chickens out. Which looks to be a near thing. Dilo's skin, usually a warm brown, has turned the color of ash. Sweat clings in droplets to his curls. His eyes dart to mine, then away. If he got my message about doing his duty, he's not looking thrilled about it. But I have more important things to do now than worry about Dilo's skyfish. As soon as I'm untied from the cart, I hurl myself to my knees and say it. Grant mercy, my lord, on your servant undeserving. Let not his punishment duly owed be exacted on his family innocent. I'm shouting the plea with the hope the Dragonborn will be satisfied by my humiliation. I'm surprised to hear my voice break, but I do not try to hide it. I can hear Rode snickering. Dilo's voice is faint.
Your plea is accepted by your lord. Rise.
I get to my feet, dizzy with a rush of relief. We stand a meter apart. Dilo's glance flits past me, towards Clan Nag.
Griff, he breathes, where is your family?
That surprises me. I thought you lot had them.
No.
That's when I notice it.
Rode's dragon, Ryla, is drooping. When she turns, I glimpse an eye crusty with mucus.
The other dragons are drooping too, tails low on the ground, wings sagging. How have none of the Dragonborn noticed? But then I realize their riders don't look much better. The Haeralian's usually olive skin is looking almost green. Faemy rubs the back of her neck like she's feeling something missing. I've seen one other person do that in my life. Nestor, their father, the Sky Widower. I look from those drooping dragons to the grey-faced Dragonborn, and shrines help me. I feel the urge to shout the triumph aloud. Antigone got here after all. My family's missing because they're safe. And these damned dragons aren't dead yet, but they sure as sparkfire have been poisoned. If I'm not mistaken, the Dractanasia's about to hit. These poor fools don't yet know what it is that's making them feel sick. In fact, the only dragon who's not drooping is Delos. I think back to the instructions I gave Mabelena and nearly smile. Looks like Delos or Jaffira got my message, took a long flight, and skipped breakfast.
Dilo, I thought I'd imagined it. This morning when Jaffira and I flew through Sailor's Folly before dawn, I thought I'd imagined a glimpse of amber scales glinting on Thorn Rose cast. Now, looking around the mound, I'm not so sure. Where are Griff's family? And why do the rest of our dragons look like they're about to keel over? He told me to tell you to take Jaffira out. Take a long flight. What if there was more to that suggestion than a casual kindness? There was a moment, weeks ago, when Griff and I gripped each other in the darkness of the lairs, and I asked him like a fool to spare the twins and my dragon, whatever he was planning. Amber scales and Thornrose cast. I know I saw them. I'm pretty sure Griff's not meeting my eyes, but I hardly know what to think of him either. With balled fists, I turned and approached the great Lord Rhadamanthus. He stands with his family in a space set apart for their officiating. Little Astyanax bounces at Lady Xanthi's elbow. Their elder children, Rode and Roxana, flank them on Dragonback, looking green and sweaty enough to vomit. I think we should call it off. Delos getting cold feet? What a surprise, Roxana mutters. She wipes a sweating forehead. It's not cold feet. Something's up. His family's missing.
So he dropped them later,
growls father, from the skyfish section. That wasn't what I meant. The rest of it's on the tip of my tongue. The amber scales, these green-faced riders. Do none of them see the drooping dragons? But then a treacherous thought occurs, and even though I should be worried about what this plot might mean for my people, I find myself thinking of what it might mean instead for a single person. Because all else aside, if I did see amber scales, Griff might still have a chance.
Father steps forward. Either you do drop him, he says, or Rhode will.
From his tone, he makes no mystery of what